안 단지에. Good morning, dear friends. Today is Tuesday, August the 23rd, in the year 2011. We are on our fifth day of the retreat with the theme Body and Mind One. Today we have one session of questions and answers. And the bell master today is Sister Concentration. Sister Concentration attended the high school, French high school. So if you would like to try your French with her, you are welcome. The children will have a chance to ask a few questions, maybe three or four. And then the teenagers will have their time to ask a few questions. After the children have asked the question, they are welcome to go out and continue their studies and practice outside. But the teenagers are requested to stay. And then we are down to have chance to ask our questions. And those of us who have a question are invited to come up here on the stage and sit around Thay. And we shall take a turn and sit on the other chair so everyone can see us before we ask the question. Before we ask the question, we listen to the bell. And everyone will be breathing in and out three times before asking the question. And we know that a good question can benefit many people. That is why we should ask the most important question, the question of our heart, a question that has to do with our happiness, suffering, practice, joy, difficulties in the practice. There are a few questions that are already written down. From time to time, we will read one of them. And if you are too shy to come up and sit there, you may like to write it down, our question on a piece of paper, and ask someone to bring it to Sister Pine, who sit close to Thay. Sister Pine is an American nun. He's there to help Thay with his English. So please, children and teenagers and young adults and grown-up people, if you have a question in your heart, please, you are invited to come up here and sit with Thay. It looks very beautiful from here. The children will ask about three questions. Remember to breathe with the bell before you ask the question.
Is meditating about having fun?
Dear Thay, our friend asked, is meditating about having fun?
To meditate is to have fun. Because if you know how to meditate, meditation will be very pleasant. If you do not know how to meditate, it may be boring, make you tired. But if you know the art of meditation, you enjoy sitting meditation, you enjoy walking meditation, you enjoy breathing in and out, you don't have to suffer. If you suffer during sitting meditation, if you suffer during walking meditation, if you suffer when you observe silence, it means you don't know yet how to meditate. To meditate is to have fun also. So I enjoy, Thay enjoy sitting. They enjoy walking. They enjoy breathing in and out. They enjoy eating in silence. And he does not suffer. In fact, he enjoyed more doing these things with meditation. It means with mindfulness. And many children are capable of doing so. During walking meditation, the children seem to be very happy. They do not talk, and yet they don't suffer. They enjoy their silence. They enjoy their steps and their breathing in and out, and when they sit down with Thay, they are very quiet. And yet they don't suffer. So you know meditation can go together with joy and happiness and fun. Good question.
Dear Thay, our friend asked, does the Buddha live in the bell?
I think so. The Buddha said that everyone can be a Buddha. Every living being can become a Buddha. Not only a man, a woman can become a Buddha, but a bird, a fish, a deer can become a Buddha. And I think in the bell there are many micro organisms. There are many tiny living beings in there. So there are many Buddhas to be in the bell. So when we bow to the bell, we bow to many Buddhas who are actually in the bell. Thank you. Good question, huh?
Can the bell be another color except for black?
Dutai, our friend wants to know, can a bell be another color besides black? Instead of black, can the bell have a different color?
Sure. Thai has a, in Plum Village, they has a bell of white color. Made of a kind of rock, white color. It sounds very beautiful also. And you can also paint the bell with the color you like. In fact, when the young practitioners asked Thay whether the Buddha is in the bell, she think that the bell, that the Buddha must be somehow very close or in the bell, because every time the bell sound, everyone listen. And the sound of the bell is like the voice of the Buddha calling us home to ourselves. And that is why she believed that the Buddha is the bell. I think the Buddha is both in the bell and outside the bell. But what is sure that the Buddha is in yourself. Because when you hear the bell, which is the voice of the Buddha, that voice does not exactly coming from the bell. Is coming from your heart. When you begin the practice, you don't see it. But if you listen to the bell and breathe for a few months, you realize that the sound of the bell does not exactly come from the outside. It's come from the inside. Because many people who are not practitioners, when they hear the bell, they don't hear the voice of the Buddha. But you, a practitioner, when you hear the bell, you recognize that that is the voice of the Buddha. And that voice of the Buddha doesn't exactly come from the bell. It comes from your own heart. And that is our insight after we have practiced listening to the bell for some time. And of course, there are many kinds of bells. There are big bells. Maybe 30 people are not enough to carry the bell. And there is a small bell that we use to bring together with us during walking meditation. It's called a mini bell. And of course, it can be brown or black or other colors. Thank you. This is our last question for children.
Is meditating healthy?
And Dutai, our friend, asks, is meditating healthy?
Healthy. It is. Because meditation can bring joy, happiness, relaxation, and bring smile and love and compassion. So all these things are elements to make you healthy. We have organized many health retreats. One health retreat just ended in the upper hamlet of Plumlish. Another one is going on in the lower hamlet of Plumlish. So meditation and health, they go together. Thank you. Now it's time for the teenagers to ask the question, and the children may like to stand up and say bye-bye. Please come up for walking meditation at 11. Have a good time outside. Some continuous. Teenagers and young adults. Brother Fablu, where are you? Brother Fablu will tell us about the wake up meeting in Buddha on the 28th of this month.
Dear Thay, dear Sangha, today I received your transmission as an order member. I'd like to ask you, what is the most important thing I can do to build Sangha?
The most important to do in order to build a Sangha is to become the first element of the Sangha, a good, excellent element of the Sangha. We know that a Sangha is made only of non-Sangha elements. And we should look around to identify the non-Sangha elements and invite them over in order to create a Sangha. And we ourselves, the Sangha builder, should be the first element. So the most important thing is to breathe in mindfully, to enjoy our in-breath, to walk mindfully, and to try to do everything with love and compassion, become fresh, loving. And that is the beginning of a good Sangha. People look at you and they like to join the practice. Thank you.
Dear Thay, if the men in power over this country were to ask you for advice, what would you tell them?
Dear Thay, our friend asked, if the men in power in this country were to ask Thay for advice, what would Thay tell them?
You think they are going to ask? Maybe the Sangha asked them to ask. In fact, we have offered a few times a talk on Capitol Hill. And this year, we also will have a retreat for congressmen. And the theme we took up last time was leading with courage and compassion. In India also, they has addressed the National Assembly with the same theme. And people listen very, very attentively. I remember one time I proposed during a talk that mindfulness should be practiced in the National Assembly Hall. And every time the atmosphere become suffocated, too hot, too tense, and no one try really to listen to no one. And then the chairperson can invite the bell for everyone to breathe in and out and calm themselves. And when the chairperson realized that the atmosphere is calm enough, and then he will allow the session to resume, to continue. And Mr. Narayan, president of the chairman of the National Assembly at that time, he liked the idea. I propose a number of things like a meditation before every session of the Congress. We can begin with a sound of the bell, and then one person will read something like meditation, that we are elected by our people in order to come together and combine our insight and experience in order to make the kind of law that will protect the country and help the people to have more well-being and reduce violence and increase happiness. So we should try to listen to each other with open heart. And we should try to use a loving speech in order to convey our insight, our experiences. Let us not betray the trust of our people, those who have voted for us. And after that, we begin the session. And when the discussion becomes hot, you use the bell of mindfulness to calm down. And after my meeting with Mr. Narayan, he created a kind of committee called Committee on Ethics for the National Assembly. He invited the former Prime Minister to be the chairman of that Committee on Ethics for the National Assembly. But not long after that, he was elected President of India, so he did not continue with his work in the National Assembly. And a few years later, I was invited to address the Congress on the theme of leading with courage and compassion. I would advise politicians to train themselves more in the art of compassionate listening and loving speech, beginning with their family. And that alone can already change a lot the life of a politician. Politicians should have a spiritual dimension in their daily life so that they know how to confront the difficulties that they encounter every day. They know how to handle the anger, the fear. And a number of congressmen in Washington, D.C. have attended a retreat not long enough, like 5 or 6 days, just only 3 days. But they have profited a lot from the retreat. A few congressmen have become senators. And I learned that there are still a number of them who continue to practice work in meditation on Capitol Hill. And one of them said that from my office to the place where I vote, I always applied the techniques of work in meditation. I stop all my thinking. I just pay attention to every step. And that helped me to survive the hectic life of a congressman. So I think this practice can benefit many of our political leaders. But you have to tell them. By one way or another. And you shouldn't tell them that you will continue to vote for them if they tell you about their spiritual dimension of their work. I think you will trust them only when he is happy in his family, in his environment, and if he's capable of handling difficult situation with clarity and compassion. And we as voters, that is the only power that we have. So we should tell them that we will continue to support them, vote for them if they go in that direction. Thank you.
Dear Thay, dear Sangha, my question deals with the first mindfulness practice. In the face of extreme violence, such as genocide, is it ever acceptable to respond to violence with action, including even violent action? I practice national security, and I think of Churchill or Chamberlain with Hitler, for instance, or more modern examples of Rwanda, Sudan, and where maybe compassionate listening with Hitler, as was done with Chamberlain, may not have been enough. And I struggle with this.
Dear Thay, our friend is asking about situations of extreme violence, and she's giving an example in the middle of the 20th century when Hitler was causing a great deal of suffering, and there was one official in England who tried to practice compassionate listening with Hitler, and it was seen as not successful and actually allowed Hitler to continue to hurt more people. And she's asking whether in certain situations is it appropriate to use violence in to stop violence.
Non-violent action is not a technique. It is a way, not as a technique. And the foundation of nonviolent action is understanding and compassion. When you have understanding and compassion in your heart, everything you do will be nonviolent. Suppose someone is killing, someone is breaking, and you arrest him, you put him in jail. Arresting that person or putting him in jail is violent and or non-violent. It depends on the situation. If you arrest that person, if you look him up, and yet you do it because of understanding and compassion, and that is non-violent action. And even if you you don't do anything, you allowed people to kill and to destroy, although you don't do anything, that is also violence. Violence can be action or non-action. So the outside, the appearance might be violent. But if you do it with the mind of understanding and compassion, it is not truly violence. Suppose a horse suffers very much and is about to die but cannot die. And if you give her a coup de grace so that he can die, it looks like violence, but it's come from your compassion. You don't want the horse to continue to suffer like that for too long. So that image tell you that the action is violent or non-violent. It depends on your heart. If you have the willingness to reduce suffering, if you understand why that person has done such a thing violently, so even if you look him up, you deprive him a few days of food, that is still nonviolent. Because depriving someone for a few days of food in order to help him to know that having something to eat is something very great, to give him that kind of insight, and that does not come from your willingness to punish, but to help him to learn and appreciate, that is nonviolence. So we should not wait until the situation presents itself to decide whether we should react with violence or nonviolence. We have to begin right now. And when the situation presents itself, we will be able to act with compassion. It means with nonviolence. Nonviolent action should be conceived as a long-term actions. When you teach your child, when you tell your child how to act, you are having nonviolent action. You don't wait until the child become cruel and begin to destroy, to kill in order to teach. You have to preventive measures. So in the realm of education, in the realm of agriculture, in the realm of art, you can introduce non-violent thinking, non-violent action, and teaching people to remove discrimination. That is the basic action of non-violence. Because violence comes from discrimination, from separation, and from hate, from fear, from anger. So helping people to transform these things before they are translated into action, that is true nonviolent action. It should begin right now, and you shouldn't wait until something happens in order to think whether we should act violently or nonviolently. And I think nonviolence can never be completely absolute. We can say that we should be as nonviolent as we could. When you think of the military, we think that the things that the military do is only violent. But to conduct an army, to protect a town, to stop an invasion of a foreign army, there are many ways to do it, and there are more violent ways, and there are less violent ways. Yeah, and you can always choose. Maybe if it is not possible to do it 100% nonviolent, but 80% nonviolent is better than 10% nonviolent. See? So don't ask for the absolute. That is the way we practice the five mindfulness trainings. You cannot be perfect in the practice. Don't worry that you will not be perfect in observing the 14 or the 5 precepts. what is important is that you are determined to go that way. You do your best. That is what we need. It's like in the forest, you get lost in the forest at night, and you don't know how to get out. And you have to look at the northern star in order to find a way. And if you go north, that does not mean that you want to arrive at the northern star. You don't need to arrive. You only need to go north. So the five trainings are like that. You should go in the direction of understanding and compassion. You don't have to be perfect. If you know that you are doing your best, that's good enough for the Sangha. That's good enough for the Buddha. So nonviolence is the same. We have to be to do our best. Thank you. One question from the floor.
Dear Thay, our friend says, several people here have had family members' lives ended, killed, by the negligence of doctors and nurses. This has caused much distress and suffering to the remaining family members. How do we change these systems? Letters written are ignored. Meetings with hospital personnel lead to nothing. What can we do so these negative behaviors and attitudes of health personnel will change toward the elderly, the disabled, and everyone else?
Well, the other day we spoke about the place of healing, and the hospital is a place of healing. And we count on technology, medicines, and the skill of doctors and nurses. But if health professionals are not happy, are not calm enough, are not relaxed enough, if health professionals suffer, and that is not it means that they cannot serve people, the patients, the best way they can. So if it happens that you are the director of a hospital, if you are the minister of health, if you are in a field of health, and you may like to meditate on that, you may invite some of your colleagues to sit down and look deeply into the topic, how to bring a spiritual dimension into the life of health professionals. We already have retreats for health professionals. We know they suffer a lot. We also have offer retreats for psychotherapists, because many therapists suffer also a lot. And if they suffer too much, they cannot help their patients, and maybe they can do harm to their patients. That is why bringing that spiritual dimension into our professional life is very important. If you do not have enough serenity, calm, patience, compassion, we cannot exercise our skill well. We can harm people, and they may sue us. So both the patients and health professionals suffer, not only patients. So when you see members of your family suffer because of the way health professionals have taken care of your beloved one, you should also see the suffering of health professionals. And you react with compassion, understanding. Instead of trying to punish them, you try to help them. You can use loving speech and other means. You have to create a public opinion, a kind of collective mindfulness, so that the people, the population, become aware of that. That is also the practice of mindfulness, helping people in your country become aware of that problem. Mindfulness of what is going on, and make enough pressure, even if it is it come from mindfulness, so that we are strong enough in order to push for a change in the circle of health activities. There must be ways to do that. And if we are so busy, we don't have the time to sit down and make up a strategy as how to create that kind of collective awareness that will help people and force people to change. Because health professionals like doctors and nurses, they may be victims of the kind of institution, the way we organize. And maybe there are those of them who want to change, but who do not have the power to change. So it should happen.
Dai, here in the States, we have something known as capital punishment. Would it, or the death penalty, would it be wrong to take someone's life if they have taken the life of another person, in your opinion?
If someone commit a crime, as someone has not even before committing the crime, that person has not been was not lucky. Parents, teachers, friends have not helped him or her. He or she did not know the way of understanding and compassion, and pushed by a feeling, an emotion of anger, hate, despair, that man has committed a crime. So he or she is somehow a victim of society. So we should feel that we are co-responsible for that crime. And in that way, when you look at him or her, we don't hate, we don't get angry. And we say that, well, if he or she had a chance to be helped, he would not have done such a thing. So with this in mind, we think that we know that killing him does not help, because our society continues to produce people like him. After you have killed one person, another person come up, and we continue to kill. That's not the solution. So you have to meditate, to look deeply, to see the roots. And don't wait until a person get to the point of education to ask the question as whether we should kill him, punish him or not. There must be a way to help change the person, to change a criminal into a non-criminal. And the Dharma may help. A criminal with the practice of the Dharma can become a savior. Like Angulimala. Angulimala was a disciple of the Buddha. He was a monk. But before that, he was ordained as a monk, he was a serial killer. He had killed almost 100 people. And King Prasenajit tried to use the army to get him, but they could not get him. That day he was about to kill the Buddha. But with his compassion and intelligence, the Buddha was able to transform him. You know the story. The Buddha is walking slowly, mindfully, holding his bowl. And Angulimala tried to run after the Buddha, and he wanted to kill the Buddha. He's full of hate. And he called out to the Buddha, "Stop, monk, stop!" And the Buddha continued to walk slowly. And then a few seconds after that, he caught up with the Buddha, and he was walking on the same line. And walking like that, he said, "Monk, I asked you to stop. Why didn't you stop?" And the Buddha said, "Angulimala, I myself, I have stopped long time ago. It's you who have not stopped." The Buddha wasn't afraid of Angulimala. I think the Buddha, when he was young, he learned martial art. He was very confident. The Buddha was young at that time. So he spoke with Angulimala, walking on the same line with him. "It's you who have not stopped. And that make Angulimala surprised. What do you mean? You are walking and you say that you have stopped. So on the path of killing, destruction, I have stopped a long, long time ago. It's you who have not stopped. And the Dhamma gave him a mini Dhamma talk. And Angulimala was full of hate and anger. Angulimala, why you like to kill people? Because I hate them. Mankind are very cruel. I want to kill them all. The Buddha said, you are misled. There are many kind people you have not seen. Look at the monks. They never try to harm anyone, even small insect. Don't you see that? If a person is full of hate and anger and violence, that person cannot be happy. Angulimala, you can change. You can be a happy person. You don't need to carry your despair and your violence, your hate, your anger like that. It's a pity that you don't know how wonderful is life. And that helped open the mind of Angulimala. He said, Gautama, it's too late. Even if I want now to change my life, it's not possible. People won't give patience. Buddha said, well, I can help you. If you truly want to change, and then I will accept you in the rank of my disciples. You become a monk, a bhikshu, and you are protected by the Dhamma. And Angulimala threw away his sword, kneel down. At that time, the disciples of the Buddha were very worried about the Buddha. And they arrived and saw that the Buddha was safe and Angulimala was kneeling in front of him. They were so happy. So the Buddha said, dear friends, let us organize a precept transmission ceremony right here on the street and ordain this gentleman into the order of bhikshu. And they form a circle. And the Buddha gave ordination together with other monks. And they shaved the head of Angulimala, the criminal, the serial killer, and gave him a monk robe. And Sariputra was given order to instruct him as how to walk, how to breathe, how to sit, how to hold the bowl of a monk. And Angulimala learned with all his heart. And in no time at all, a few weeks, he became very gentle, very nonviolent, very pleasant monk. Transformation took place very quickly. And one criminal become one very, very kind, compassionate person. And that is the miracle of the Dhamma. And he got a new name, Ahimsaka Thera, the monk called nonviolent action. A few weeks after that, the king was still trying to use his army to look out for Angulimala. And the Buddha one day saw the king with his army. He said, is anything happening, why you have to arrange the army? No, the border is safe. Only we have not found Angulimala. Because until we find Angulimala and kill him, there will not be no peace in the kingdom. The Buddha pointed to a monk behind him and said, "This is Angulimala." And all the hair in the head of the king stood up. The Buddha said, "Majesty, you don't have to be afraid. Angulimala has become someone very gentle, non-violent. You can have confidence in me." And then, after a few minutes of breathing in and out, the king recovered his calm. And he turned to Angulimala and he asked about his origin and offered his help, to offer food, shelter. And Angulimala thanked the king and said that he does not need anything because everything is being given to him by the Sangha. And that is the story of transformation. And if politicians, the justice system, know the practice of the Dharma, they may be able to apply that to prisons and other places and help prisoners to transform. There is a Dharma teacher in our midst, Sherry Mapo. She had served a long time as a police officer. She has practiced the Dharma for a long time. She has become a Dharma teacher. She has helped so many people, including police officers. And you may like to talk to her about how to help bring the Dharma into the system and help transform the people who have not got a chance. And punishment is not the only way. It's not the best way.
Dear Thay, dear Sangha, I'm 23 years old, and one of the first things I learned from Thay's teachings a few years ago when I first encountered them is that I cannot love others if I cannot love myself, and that to help others I must be able to help myself, and also that willingness to love is not the same as capacity to love. After a couple of years of practicing, I tried to enter a relationship, but found that my suffering still came to dominate the relationship, so I left that relationship. And as a young practitioner, my question is, how do I know when I'm ready to truly love and help others? And how do I know when I'm ready for a long-term commitment?
Many of us believe that it is easier to love another person than to love oneself. To accept oneself and to love oneself is harder. But And according to the teaching, when you have not accepted yourself, you have not been able to love yourself, your love for the other person may not be true, even if the willingness to love and to make him or her happy is real. There may be conflict within ourselves. We don't want to do it, but we still do it. We don't want to say it, and yet we still say it. It's stronger than us. Why? So you hate yourself. You don't want to say it, and yet when time comes, you just say it. When you don't want to do it, and yet when the time comes, you still do it. And you regret later, and you beat your chest, you pull your hair. You cannot accept yourself. And that energy that pushes you to do the thing you do not want to do, the energy that pushes you to say the thing you don't really want to say, that is called the habit energy. It's stronger than us. And it may have transmitted from our parents, our ancestors. So the Buddhist teaching is to look deeply into ourselves, our body, our feelings, our perceptions, our mental formation, our consciousness, in order to see that many of these things have been a continuation of our father, our mother, our ancestors. That is, there is no separate self. The I is made of non-I element. The me is made of non-me element. And when we hate ourselves, we hate all our ancestors, because we are the continuation of our ancestors. If one of our ancestors was lucky enough to encounter the Dharma, he or she could have transmitted that kind of habit energy and not transmit to us. But since he did not have the chance to encounter the Dharma and transform it, he has transmitted that him habit energy to you. But now you have that opportunity to encounter the Dharma, you say, dear ancestors, let us work together, you and I. There is a Dharma. And if we train ourselves, we'll be able to change, transform the habit energy into something else. And when we transform that in us, we transform that for our parents, our ancestors. So the right view is that the self is made of only of non-self elements. So when you hate the self, you hate all the non-self elements. And that one who is responsible for that action, for that word, comprise all the non-self elements. And when you are able to apply the teaching, the practice, to transform it, you do it not only for you, but for your ancestors, your parents. We are very kind to help all ancestors in you to transform. And your ancestors liberated in you will smile and get free. So we should practice with that kind of love. Love for ourselves, love for our ancestors. We have received the heritage. We have to accept it as it is. And after having accepted it, we feel peaceful. And that is the point. To be where to begin. You have to accept the the situation as it is. We have to accept ourselves as we are. And that is possible with the insight of no self. There is always a way out. And this way out proposed by Buddha is to look deeply, to touch the nature of no self. And if you can touch the nature of no self, and you accept yourself, because you know that you are made of non-you elements, and no complex anymore, you are doing that for all of us. There was a Vietnam War veteran who came to one retreat. In Northern California, he could not accept himself. He had done, during the war, the Vietnam War, he had done something horrible. He had killed 5 children. That day, one of his friends was killed in an ambush. So he went home with a lot of anger. And the next day he came with a bag of sandwiches. And he put explosive in the sandwiches in the place in that village where his companion was killed. He wanted to retaliate. And he hid himself. And 5 children came out from the village and they discovered the sandwiches so delicious. And they were eating. And after having eaten the sandwich, they cry. They react. And their parents came and trying to help. But it was a very remote area in the countryside of Vietnam. And even if they have a car, they have not enough time to transport the children to a hospital very much. He knew that the 5 children were going to die because of his action. He survived the war and went back to America. And from that day, he could not sleep. He saw 5 children always in his dreams and in his daily life. And every time he found himself sitting with children in one piece, in one room, he could not bear it. He has to run out of the room right away. Until one day he learned there was a retreat reserved for war veterans. He came and he practiced. One day, he had the opportunity to tell people about his suffering. He had not been able to tell that story to anyone except his mother. His mother tried to help. "My son, that's the things that happen in a war, but that is not enough to help him." So in one of our sitting and listen deeply, because of a lot of silence and compassion offered by many of us, most of us were Vietnamese. Direct or indirect victims of the war. He was not able to speak out. Until one day he was able to tell us the truth. And I gave him some instructions as how to get out of that guilt so that he can accept himself. I said, "David, You have killed 5 children. But you are still young. You can use your time and energy in order to save 5 children. If you have killed 5 children in the past, today, tomorrow, after tomorrow, you can help save 5, 10, 15 children. Children are dying every day, everywhere. And some of them die just because they need one tablet of medicine. And you can, there are many things you can do in order to save several dozens of children every day. Why stay there and cry and hate yourself? Do something. And I gave him the will, the desire, the willingness, that is kind of food called a volition, a compassionate action. You kill 5 in the past, but you can save 50 in 1 year or 2 years. Use your life in order to do that. And after the talk, he was released. And he began to do what Thay suggested him to do. So insight is very important. If you cannot accept us, we have to practice looking deeply and to see the past, to see the future in the light of no self. And the path of liberation will open in front of us, and transformation can take place very quickly than you can imagine, more quickly than you can imagine. And when you have accepted yourself, you know how to take care of yourself. You know that by taking care of yourself, you are taking care of all of us. Because self is made of non-self element. The tree outside, standing outside, very healthy. It does not look that the tree is doing very much for us. But a tree should be a real tree. Healthy, beautiful. If a tree is less than a tree, all of us will get into trouble. That is why a tree should be a tree. And a human being should be a real human being. And if we are a good human being, that is the basic thing we can do in order to help the world. To be healthy, to be compassionate, to be understanding, to love. And that is the practice of love of the Buddha. Take good care of yourself. Accept yourself. And that is to help people already. And it is possible today. You don't have to wait until the time when you think that you are capable of loving. You can do it right here and right now with insight and compassion. And the Sangha will support you.
Dear Sangha, yesterday when you spoke about the sutra of mindful breathing, you mentioned 4 methods: impermanence, non-craving, cessation, and letting go. And perhaps since I have not yet mastered the 4th one, I felt impatient to hear more about it, and I wasn't sure if you had covered it and I didn't understand, or if you were planning to talk about it tomorrow, if that was the case, you can ignore my question. But I think my heart would like to learn more about letting go, especially from the perspective of letting go before tension actually builds. Because I think in my practice I have learned how to let go in meditation or doing body work, but not necessarily being a sensitive woman, feeling energies, picking up energy sometimes in a sponge-like way. How to let go in the moment in a healthy way before attention builds in the first place.
Dear Thay, our friend was recalling that yesterday Thay spoke about the 16th exercise from the Sutra on the Full Awareness of Breathing, about letting go. And she would like to understand more about the practice of letting go, and especially in her situation. She can practice letting go in certain moments, like when she's practicing meditation or receiving care of her body. But at other times, she finds that she's reacting to things happening around her or in a relationship. And she wants to know, how can she practice letting go in those moments so that the tension doesn't build from the beginning?
The 16th exercise of mindful breathing, letting go, is about letting go, first of all, the notion of lifespan. Because we believe that we have a lifespan that lasts more or less 100 years. And if we got the insight of no birth and no death, we can remove that. That will bring a lot of freedom, non-fear. As for the other practice of letting go, well, there are many ways. And we have already learned that the more we let go, the happier we can become. We are released from letting go of an idea to letting go of the things we think that are crucial to our survival. And those ideas are those things, including a person. Instead of making our happiness, can be an obstacle for our happiness, because it does not provide us with enough freedom. I think finding true happiness, getting in touch with real conditions of happiness, is one of the most pleasant and easiest way to let go. Usually we have an idea that this should be like this and that should be like that in order for us to be happy. But the reality can be different. Even this continue to be like this and that continue to be like that, and yet happiness can be also possible. So breathing in, you recognize the basic conditions of your happiness. Do you have enough freedom? What deprives you of your freedom? Maybe what is happening in the moment deprives you of your freedom. it does not deprive others of that freedom because their way of looking is different. But you, because of your way of looking, and that is why what is happening deprive you of happiness. So it depends on our way of looking. That the situation is like this or like that. And that kind of release takes place in your mind, in your way of looking. Breathe and get in touch with the true condition of happiness. They don't need to be many. It may be just one condition of happiness. And that is enough for us to release all the other notions. And if you are free, and you are happy, and then you are in a situation to have change. If you are not happy, you are not free, you cannot change the situation. So freedom is the foundation of everything. There are things you like to do, and we believe that if you can do that, happiness will be great. But if conditions do not allow us to do it, we can still be happy. Because reality is as wonderful as it is. And practicing apranihita, aimlessness, you find out that happiness is possible in the here and the now. You don't have to realize the dream in order to be happy. This is it. You don't look for something else. And that needs some insight. And that insight brings freedom. Dwelling happily in the present moment. That's the basic teaching of the Buddha. There are so many conditions of happiness that are there. To be alive. To be making steps on this beautiful planet is wonderful enough. And if you can be happy with that, then you can help change other things for other people. This is a happy moment. When we do not have anything to do, we just sit together and breathe as a Sangha and become a cell in the body of the Buddha. It's very nice. Brother Fabulu. Prepare yourself. After this question, come and talk to us about wake up.
Dear Thay, during this retreat, you've talked very powerfully about purifying and developing our minds. And you've also talked about integrating science and Buddhism. And I was wanting to ask you if you would consider the possibility of at some point permitting neuroscientists to study your mind and perhaps the brothers and sisters' minds and brains so that we can look more deeply at also the biological processes in the neural substrates through EEG, functional MRI, SPECT scans and these things. I know in other traditions they've done it, and it could help not only scientists but I think humankind. And sometimes neuroscientists, some of them don't even understand meditation all that well. I had a neuroscientist colleague of mine say to me about ADHD children, oh, meditation, that's the worst thing to help them focus. And he was involved with neurofeedback to teach the brain how to. So I think it could benefit many people if you might consider it.
I think the Buddha is a scientist. He understands his mind very well. He understands the mind of another person very well. And he did not need any instrument. He did not need to put electrode and things like that to find out. I think the most important discoveries of Albert Einstein come when he had only one sheet of paper and one pencil. He did not need any sophisticated instrument. In the Buddhist tradition, we see the mind as the most important instrument to get knowledge. To get insight. It's like a mirror. If you remove all the dust, and it will reflect the world as it is. So the mind of the scientist is also a mirror. And if the scientists know how to remove the dust from their mind, their suffering, their afflictions, their prejudices, their anger, their fear. And then that would be the best instrument a scientist can have. And that's what we should discuss during the retreat between Buddhist practitioners and science. I don't believe much in measuring the mind in order to understand, the brain in order to understand the mind. Yeah. Has they answered the question? Yes. Blue, please talk to us about the next event of Wake Up for Young People.
We'll have Fab Lin, Sister Hienyam, if you could come up too. Fab Yung.
Thay Fab Yung.
So, dear Thay, dear Sangha, we are planning a Wake Up tour for the U.S. to happen the middle of October till the beginning of November, and it's quite exciting. We're about to kind of launch it publicly today or tomorrow, and so this is the first time we've been announcing it officially at a retreat in the U.S. And the idea is that we go to universities, so we use the space that's available for, that students can easily get and professors at universities to bring mindfulness to young people who are studying, who are involved in community work, who we're going to go to a detention center in New York City for incarcerated youth, a hospital in Philadelphia where there are young people with chronic illnesses. So the idea, we go straight to them, so they don't have to come to a retreat, you know, and that's the obstacle of paying for the retreat and so forth. And we've already tested this. We've gone to the UK, and we had 2 weeks where we went to a bunch of universities, including Cambridge, Oxford,
Leeds. We did a day of mindfulness in Brighton. We went to Imperial College in London and the School of Oriental and African Studies. And the idea is that we go not as just one Dharma teacher or two Dharma teachers, but we go as a whole group of young Dharma teachers and young monastics. And the emphasis is not so much on teaching. I mean, we do share the practice of mindfulness just as we do in the retreat, but it's more about connecting, you know, really having one personal relationships with the students. And what resulted from the tour in the UK is we have, I think, the strongest wake-up group in the world, really, in London now, a bunch of young people, because they were involved in helping us organize, because they came on some of the days of mindfulness, on some of the afternoon panel discussions that we had, that they have now, some of them are considering doing the five-year program to be a monastic for 5 years that Tai has introduced this past year. Some of them are organizing flash mob meditation sessions. I don't know if you're familiar with this. It's quite inspiring, actually. And there's some videos online if you look in Trafalgar Square. And after the shootings in Oslo, there was another flash meditation mob. It's a very beautiful practice. People come together. You don't know that they're all kind of, they've planned on Facebook already. At a certain time, with a certain signal, they would all sit down in the middle of Trafalgar Square or a big public space and practice meditation for half an hour. So these kind of things have been the result, the fruit of us going on tour in the UK. And so we'd like to bring that now to US soil. And so our plan now is we've been invited to go to a few places already. So we've been invited to go to Harvard to do a day of mindfulness on the 22nd of October. To Yale University, I think it's the 5th of November, and we are going to Washington, D.C. with Tai, and we're planning on that Saturday, which is the 29th, to, we don't have a venue yet, but we'd like to do a day of mindfulness for young people there. And then in between, we'd be doing a number of smaller things, like I said, going to a detention center in New York City. We're planning to do a day of mindfulness, hopefully downtown in New York City, if we can find a place to do it. So we could actually do walking, maybe in Union Square. So many, many things. I can't really list them all. So we want to present it to you because we'd like to ask for your support. We're going to be launching a campaign online to raise some funds because we tried to make it a self-funding exercise, and so we're going to be renting a van, paying for food and so forth. And some places we'll find accommodation, but some places we may have to, you know, it's nice, we will stay in Zen centers, we make a donation, things like that. So we're starting a campaign on a site called Indiegogo. Many of you may have seen it when we were raising money for the film that they're making about Tai's trip, this tour. So we're starting a campaign probably today or tomorrow. And if you feel inspired to support the tour financially, then you may like to make a donation, and that would be well appreciated, even if it's just, you know, $5 or $10. We made a CD to support the tour with the song that you learned just before the Dhamma talk today, Unborn and Indestructible, a wake-up song, many other songs that we've recorded recently with the monks and nuns and other lay friends. And that will be something that if you make a certain donation, you can get a free copy of that music, that CD. So if you'd like to support us, you can go to a website. It's called us.wkup.org. So you may be familiar with the wake-up website already, which is wkup.org. We will announce it there as well, but we have a more specific one just for the U.S., which is us.wkup.org. So there'll be information there about how you can donate if you like to make a donation. If you are in the Northeast and you know young people especially who are in colleges and universities, we still have maybe a little bit of space we can work around if it works that we're nearby. We're going to be around Boston from the 20th of October to the 22nd. We've tried to do something maybe in New Hampshire, maybe at Dartmouth or somewhere, I don't know, around the New Hampshire, Vermont area on the 23rd or 24th. And then we go down to Washington, D.C. from the 25th to the 30th. And then the 30th, actually, we go up to Philadelphia. So we'll spend a couple of days at UPenn and at a hospital there, the 30th, 31st. And then we go to Brown, to Providence, Rhode Island, from the 1st to the 3rd, and then 3rd to the 5th, we're in New Haven. And then the rest of the tour, the 6th to the 9th, will be in New York City. So maybe that's a little bit complicated schedule. But if you know, especially we're looking in New York City for support, still in Boston to do some events. We may be working with young people in the Youth Build group. We'd like to connect with them. One of our Dhamma teachers in our tradition is helping with training young people in who are in poor neighborhoods to become community leaders. And so these are all the things that we're kind of, some of them are planned, some of them are in a nascent form. So if you have any suggestions, you can come up to me. I'll be at this table over here where this the laptop is, where we're streaming Thay's talk online now. And you can share it with me about it. If you'd like to make a donation right now, you can do that too. And just come up. We don't have an official way to do it here, but if you go online after the retreat, you can help support us. And I'd like to just share as well that we do have a 5-year program for young monastics and young young people who want to spend some of their life really learning how we live as monastics and learning the practice that Thay is teaching. And we're in the process of making that a training program in the U.S. at Deer Park and at Blue Cliff for young people to go and become an aspirant, a novice, and a full monk or nun, and then leave in good faith from the community and become a lay, perhaps a lay Dhamma teacher after 5 years of training. So that's a path that's open to young people if they're interested to really put into practice these teachings and realize it in their lives. And so please, if you can come up to any of the monastics and ask us about it, and we can tell you, give you more information as to how can you try this out, try this life out. It's a wonderful way to begin your life, to really train to be a good member of society and a wonderful husband or wife or partner and father and mother to your children. So thank you. And we also have an event coming up in right here in Boulder. It's in Naropa University, and it will be on Sunday.
At what time?
It will be at Sunday at Naropa University. I'm not sure what time. If Brother Fabsiu is here, he could tell you. It's on the front page of the Wake Up website, so wkup.org. Yeah, and It's 11 to 5 at Naropa University. And again, these wake-up events, we're trying to connect with young people. So if you know young people in the area and they can come, you know, if they're between 18 and 32, please encourage them to come to this event. It'll be very lovely. Okay, thank you.
Dear friends, if you have left your book on the stage for Thay to sign, they're all in these two bags, so please come and pick up your book. Thay has signed them this morning.